All right, now can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Cool. So, yeah, just whatever essential information you think people need to hear before they see Bone Tomahawk, the movie you produced. You can introduce yourself if you want.
Sure. My name is Greg Zuck, and I'm one of the producers of the film Bone Tomahawk. It comes out in theaters and on iTunes, VOD, and every other sort of rollout that can happen electronically and still make you pay this Friday, October 23rd. And, I guess the number one thing I would say about the film is that it's one of those, I guess, rare character-driven Westerns that you just haven't seen since, you know, really the last one that came out was Kurt Russell's last one, which was Tombstone. And so I guess if you're a fan of Westerns and you're a fan of good acting and you know, a few splashes of very, very horrific and graphic violence, then this film's for you.
It's being billed as a horror Western, but it's definitely more Western than it is horror. But the parts that have horror in them are definitely dialed up to, like, the highest volume. So it's a very
pretty much
original movie-going experience if you're a fan of either of those genres, I feel like.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it's definitely being billed as a horror Western, but I think it's more just because those few instances of graphic violence are just horrific, and the kind of the creatures and the riff on the original Native American stereotype is cannibal. So it's kind of got this weird, almost Hills Have Eyes meets the movie Searchers, which is kind of where the plot kind of derives from. Is it's an homage to John Wayne's Searchers, where you have a couple townspeople in a remote Western town kidnapped, and the remaining townspeople band together and journey off into the harsh wilderness to try and rescue them. And in this case, rather than Native Americans, we've got these rare breed of cave-dwelling cannibalistic troglodytes that are, can't really say much more to them. There's a whole lore to it within the director's head that he's refusing to kind of give any more information on, because he really does want to just keep it up to you what you think they are and what you think they could be.
And so that's a great synopsis. Production began. What drew you work for Caliber Media, we should say. What drew your company to this project? What you think?
Totally.
Yeah.
So Caliber Media, when I started working here, was a literary management and production company, and it was really this project that shifted the kind of genesis of this company, and it made it the sole point to make this movie. Originally, one of the founders, Dallas Sanye, had been representing S. Craig Zahler, the writer and director of this film, and I guess through representing him for years and years and years selling his screenplays, Craig just got a little, perturbed by the fact that he would sell and write so many screenplays for Hollywood, and out of the 22, 23, or 24, depending on who you ask, that he sold, only one of them has actually been made over that period of time. And it's this movie called Asylum Blackout. It was made by a bunch of Frenchmen with British actors and all these things, just kind of, not his cup of tea. He's a very naturalistic writer and director.
Right.
If you're writing about an American, he wants you to have an American actor. If you're doing a Brit, it's got to be a British actor. And so he had never seen anything he actually wrote turn into what he wanted. So it kind of turned to the point where he just wanted to make something. So he sat down with his agent in Dallas and was like, what should I do? He'd originally been writing or at least watching these kind of low micro-budget, like $60,000, $70,000 horror movies. And so he was prepared to just go take his credit card and make one of those movies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess Dallas and his agent Julian, since Craig is, kind of broke into the scene writing Westerns, they both convinced him, why not write a Western? So that's exactly what he did. He wrote a low budget Western, something that he knew could be makeable, not obviously for the micro budget horror level, but for a small enough budget that he could kind of just go out there and make it. And so he wrote it in what it was, 28 days, something like that. And then that was about 3 or 4 years ago. And since then, he's just been taking it around and trying to attach cast and and get the movie made with Caliber as kind of the backbone of it, the commitment to 100% go out and make it. And so that's kind of how it wasn't even like we were really going looking for it. It was just a combination of wanting to support Craig's career and realizing that you had someone so talented and who could write something that we really wanted to go out and make.
Yeah, and you can definitely tell when you're watching the movie that unlike a lot of other Westerns or horror movies in which the director is sort of interchangeable and he doesn't really have a voice, Bone Tomahawk certainly does, and you can tell this guy was making very, very deliberate decisions, especially with the dialogue and the pacing of the movie. It feels like an art film as much as it feels like a genre film.
Absolutely, and I think that's, you know, the number one reason why the film got made is because of Craig's vision as a director and a writer and just being so in tune with what he wanted out of it. You know, it's the type of thing where if you read a script, the director can take it 1,000 different ways and, you know, it could go really just fall apart very quickly. But because he knew, he wrote every word, he knew exactly what he wanted out of it. That's really how it happened. You know, without that sort of very deliberate vision, as you're referring to, the film doesn't happen. The movie doesn't. I mean, especially with how many obstacles there really were along the way, whether it was budget size, time, you name it, pretty much this movie had to deal with it. You know, that's kind of the positive and negative of making a low budget movie. It's very easy because you don't need that much money, but it's very difficult because you don't have a lot of money.
Sure.
So it's kind of a catch 22, I suppose.
And just he is a first time director. He directed some short films beforehand.
So Craig's background is he went to NYU Kish Film School in I think the 90s, and he was a cinematographer during that period of time. He kind of shot a bunch of low-budget indie movies. I don't even know them. He's never actually sent them to me. He's kind of always referred to them as just like his you know, cutting his bones as
sure.
a cinematographer, learning set, things like that. But it was really after he stopped doing the cinematography, he was a catering chef. For 10 years and just use it as an opportunity to, you know, pay rent and then write day in and day out. And so that was really the period where Craig Zoller became Craig Zoller and was able to kind of focus on writing and mm-hmm. what he wanted his end product to be.
Because for a first-time director, just the different feels and mood that he has colliding on the screen, because you literally have dialogue that's out of Deadwood, basically, like very antiquated, composed
mm-hmm.
dialogue that's then abutting these explosions of violence and these very, very quiet sort of scenes of them just riding horses across the pasture without a single word being said for sometimes 3 or 4 minutes. It's just a tracking shot, basically. So,
yeah, no, and
that he could pull off that stuff on his first try was, like, very impressive.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't have been possible had he not written the movie himself.
Yeah.
Because he knew exactly what he wanted. And it's kind of funny you mentioned the antiquated dialogue. There were definitely times where, even after I've watched the movie as many times as I have, I had to ask
you've probably seen it, 40 times now?
12 or 13. But
okay.
I literally had to ask, and there's a scene in the movie where there's the word hail is used, and I was just like, wait, did he mean the piece of ice falling from the sky? And I guess I should have realized this the amount of times I've walked by a hail and hearty, healthy. I should have realized that.
Honey bunches of oats.
Exactly. He kind of infuses this dialogue, and then the long tracking shots and the whole, you know, it's just he knew what he wanted. The only word you can kind of give to that is vision, and to have that kind of vision is just someone who's clearly thought about it and knows exactly what he wants, which he does 100%.
And this was his first time directing, and this was your first time producing a feature length.
This is definitely my first legitimate credit at a feature. I've produced a couple short films back when I went to NYU, and then since I've been at Caliber, I've been involved with five movies, depending on how you kind of look at it, and mostly in the post-production and legal delivery end of it. So doing kind of all the things that nobody wants to do, which is paperwork and making sure that everything gets done, really. That's my number one responsibility is just getting the thing done and finishing it. I wasn't, and I'll be the first to admit on this movie, I was not the most involved person on set. My number one responsibility was driving Craig, who does not have a driver's license and hasn't had a driver's license for like 15 years, to and from set, since we were shooting a micro-budget indie film in Los Angeles, of all places, which most people would think is like the complete antithesis of independent filmmaking. And so
the whole movie was shot in California?
Yeah, it was shot in Paramount Ranch, which is in Malibu. That's where all the Western set was. And then we just shot in this vast, kind of very interesting, at least topographically speaking, canyon area in Santa Clarita, California, which is about 45 minutes east of Los Angeles. And so, yeah, I just drove him to and from set every day. That was kind of on set, you know, doing runs, filling in, doing all the little things that we just didn't have money to afford. But really, on set, it was to make sure that the director wasn't late and that he got home and didn't, you know, get into a major car accident, which would have derailed the whole production.
That would be problematic.
So it was completely successful there. But apart from that, you know, it was really, when I stepped into my role, it was really finishing the movie, overseeing posts, and making sure, like, all the visual effects were done, the editor had everything needed and was able to get everything ready to be passed out to the sound, and then finally delivering the whole movie.
Because I don't. Do they ever explicitly say where the town is in the movie?
No, it's never specific. There were probably five different iterations of this movie before we actually ended up shooting in California.
Sure.
But originally we were shooting it out in Utah. Then there was New Mexico. Then there was, we actually looked into Spain and Australia, and then Romania. It kind of could have been anywhere. I was always told the closest actual location was New Mexico, but really it's a non-specific out in the middle of nowhere western town.
And the town in which you shot has basically been standing since the 50s and 60s when they would shoot westerns there, right? And basically the
Paramount Ranch is literally built by Paramount to just be their western set, and I think it's in like 50 or 60 movies. Even, you know, I've seen a few interviews with Kurt where he even said that back when he was doing TV westerns in the 60s, he worked on Paramount Ranch at least once. It's just like one of those that everybody used, and it's been set and reset and reshot from different angles a thousand different times, and it's just been, you know, kind of a pillar of westerns, which is cool because it kind of, you know, continues along this homage of trying to create a modern western.
And what was I going to say? Oh, basically, this started filming last October. Basically,
just
a timeline for some insider baseball stuff, like a timeline for what it would take to make a movie of this type of budget and scale.
So we literally started pre-production, I think, the last 2 weeks of September and then started shooting the very first week of October. And I was back in New York City on Halloween. So took us about, we shot for 21 and a half days, depending on who you ask. So our last day went particularly long. It was like a 19, 20, 21 hour day. And so, I mean, just to give scope, the script's 138 pages. Shooting in 21 and a half days means we averaged like 6 or 7 or 8 pages a day, which just for Hollywood standards, most Hollywood movies, TV shows shoot like 2-3 pages a day. I think Woody Allen averages like 6 or 7, who he's supposed to be one of the fastest filmmakers kind of out there.
Sure.
And the most we shot in a day was 10 and 3/4 of pages.
Okay.
So
that's literally like 10 minutes of the movie in one day.
Exactly, which again was something that we were told was just going to be impossible. And everybody who could ask Craig to cut pages, you know, because that's kind of the one thing with an independent movie is if you have X amount of dollars and Y amount of time and you've got Z amount of pages, you need to reduce one of those things, and you're not obviously going to reduce or increase the time or the budget because you just don't have it. You
right.
cut pages, and that's usually how you make these things happen. And Craig was totally willing to cut pages if we didn't make our days and we were starting to go rapidly behind, and it just didn't happen. He stayed on schedule. I think we went over like 2 or 3 times over the course of the production,
mm-hmm.
which is really not crazy. And so we were able to get everything, literally. I mean, we went long on the last day, but because we had to get everything. But then, I mean, for Scope, we literally premiered the movie less than a year after we finished shooting it, which is kind of unheard of. I've worked on a few other projects and seen, you know, lengths of production going for, you know, 2-3 years to just finish a movie. And this was 1 year from cameras roll to, you know, release, which is wild.
Sure. And is that a industry template, like the 21-day film shoot? Because I don't know if this is a sidebar, but if you've been watching Project Greenlight.
Yeah.
They're also on a 21-day shoot, and I think they have a similar budget, and script might be a little shorter, but I was just wondering if that's like, if you have this type of movie, this type of budget, this size crew, is 21 days to like...
I think that's like, because that's, you know, roughly 4-5 day weeks.
Okay.
So that kind of works for that, but for example, the horror movie that actually we also produced called Condemn that released at Scream Fest, a horror film festival in LA yesterday, was 18 days, and we did 3 6-day weeks.
Okay.
So it really just depends on how much money you have. The typical like Magnolia, I think, shot what, 6 months, something like that.
Sure.
And you just
eyes wide shut, 2 years.
Exactly. Like if you can take forever to shoot things, then go for it. You know, you will find something special in that amount of time. But I think with this amount of money and the pressure behind it, I actually think having a shorter shoot helps. You know, it forces you to just get the movie and get it out. If you have those few extra days, you'll find yourself kind of second guessing yourself and finding you've wasted more time than actually utilizing it. It's a gauntlet. It's like, hey, I've got 21 days, got this much to cover. How am I going to do it? It's like the ultimate problem solving.
Sure.
You kind of just have to approach it. But I guess if 21 days, I would say the 4 weeks, definitely is a good establishing point for independent films, but everyone's different. It really is. It all comes down to, and it really does all just come down to the director and what he thinks he can achieve in that amount of time.
And there were no reshoots or anything? It was basically just editing from the time filming ended until...
You actually start editing while you're filming.
Oh, wow.
So one thing I actually did, apart from driving Craig to and from set, is I would take the footage that was copied and transcoded overnight to the editor so that they could begin to put up the dailies so that people could view them and be getting rough scene string outs. So, yeah, the editor, Fred Raskin, who also conveniently is editing The Hateful Eight and is one of, just so happens to be one of Craig's college roommates from NYU.
Oh,
we were lucky to have, like...
Okay.
Exactly. So we were able to have like an extremely competent and consummate editor working on our projects and kind of help steer the post process pretty much from day one. He was on with his assistant, just jumping into it and getting everything prepared. So the editing process, and I say we probably edited until the second or third week of February,
okay.
just locking the final picture locked edit. And then after that, you take it to your sound facility and your DI or digital intermediary facility. This used to be where you would take your developed film and you would kind of cut it together and paste it together. But now since everything's digital, they just take the edit that you did on your program on your computer and they line all the raw footage back up. And so since we shot on Red, that's actually a bit of a task because each file is massive. So it takes a considerable amount of time and focus to kind of do that. So that those are the next two parts of post, and then of course visual effects. Which this movie does not have a lot of visual effects. I would say it has two or three, but for the most part, they're not very noticeable because it's not heavy CGI. The majority of the visual effects work was cleanup. Since Craig was very adamant about doing everything practically.
Sure.
So, and this is frankly one of the coolest things that I got to experience out of it was I had no idea how these Westerns in the 50s, 60s, 70s did like the bow and arrow stuff. You know, you would think now, you would just composite a 3D arrow into that, right? Like that makes sense. So the way you actually do it is absolutely brilliant is you take fishing wire and you cut a hole through each end of the arrow. and you just use it like a zip line, and you zip the arrow along the fishing wire into like a pad underneath all of the clothing.
Yeah.
And it's pretty cool. And it again, decisions like that where Craig did not want to use visual effects or special effects ended up really helping the movie and making a cool kind of, again, homage to these past Westerns where we were working with no money and needed to get the same effects, and it ends up looking better.
Yeah.
I'm a big believer that practical effects always look better than visual effects. It's just, you know, the difference between computer-generated stuff and what is real and what's actually...
Jar Jar Binks and Yoda. You always want to err on the side of Yoda when possible.
Except in episode 1, 2, and 3. And then you don't want to err on the side of Yoda at all.
But you haven't talked about any of the actors that you got to work with, and so it's Kurt Russell, Patrick Wilson.
Yeah, that should actually be the starting. Can we restart this interview?
I actually can't edit it at all. But
but yeah,
start
so
right
just,
here.
The other wonderful aspect about this film, and one of the other pillars as to why this movie happened for the amount of money, is we had a phenomenal cast, which is a testament to the script that Craig wrote, that all these actors were interested in doing a role that was not a payday in any stretch of the imagination. But we had Kurt Russell, Patrick Wilson, Matthew Fox, Richard Jenkins, and Lily Simmons as our leads. And they were just phenomenal. You can see it in the performances that when you have true consummate professional actors, you're going to get a better end product because they can do what might take some actors 6, 7, 8, 9 takes. They might get in one. And so you don't have to, even though you would like to give them more time to suss things out and get it to where they like, unfortunately in a lot of situations you just don't have that amount of time when you're just pumping through pages, and it just benefited us so much to know that, you know, they could get it in 1, 2 if it was a little rough on the first go. And then if we had time, we could give them their 3rd or 4th or 5th takes, but we just didn't need it because they were so good. And, you know, it's going to be particularly a couple of these actors who I feel like have never been seen in this kind of light before. One of whom, Matthew Fox, you know, obviously very, very well known for his work on the TV series Lost, but hasn't had an opportunity to do a kind of role. He plays John Bruder in it, who's kind of the womanizing gunslinger of the town. And he came to set the first day just enthusiastic and just really crushed it. He really got into the role, and I think most people are going to be shocked by seeing such a side of him that they've never really seen before. Obviously, Kurt is fantastic. You know, he's everything you would expect as a leading man and someone who's been in Hollywood for as long as he has and delivers a performance, you know, almost effortlessly. And Patrick Wilson, Richard Jenkins are two of the finest actors really in Hollywood who don't, you know, they may not get as much credit, though Richard did just win an Emmy for his work on Olive Kittredge, but he's, you know, almost unrecognizable in this film. He's got this crazy hair, this crazy beard. He plays the affable backup deputy Chicory, and he's just, I mean, his performance is incredible. I really hope that if this film does get awards hit, that he gets recognized for his work, and really all of them deserve to be recognized for their work on this, considering all of the challenges that they faced across the, you know, along the way.
Oh, definitely, especially on such a short shoot, all compounded by the fact that they're not really going out and saying modern day vernacular. They're speaking in there's literally Shakespearean monologues in this movie. I think Richard, one of the best like parts of the movie is Richard Jenkins' performance, and he gives this toward the end of the movie maybe 5-6 minute long monologue. It's kind of like puts a really nice button on where every character is at that moment. And
totally, and I assume you're referring to the Flea Circus monologue, which is
yes.
The fact that he was able to nail it as quickly as he was, because, I mean, we were running out of time at that point. We didn't know when he even admits he didn't know where we were going to shoot it, and he was just able to nail it. And that's the other thing, is it's not a dialogue-light, action-packed Western. It's very much about the characters and the dialogue. That's what I think separates it from most films, is especially in you know, modern-day filmmaking, you see more times than not, special effects and crazy chase sequences and all of the various, you know, eye-teasing aspects of filmmaking get put over good character development, making you care about, I mean, to me, that's the number one thing that makes you care about any story is whether you actually care about what's happening to the characters, if they'll survive, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what this film is all about. You know, sure, there are cannibalistic troglodytes at the end of the road, and there's the constant thought in the back of your mind that you know something crazy is going to happen. I assure you, something crazy does happen. But it's really just about these characters and their struggle that they're and to getting to know each other and how they interact and how they develop this sort of bond and this friendship where they're going through hell. They're going, you know. There are many points in the movie where there doesn't look like there is any hope, and there might not be any hope. And yet you care so much more, and it seems that much more hopeless because you've experienced them become friends with one another. And that's really the only way I can think about how people become friends is talking to each other and the conversations you have and the experiences that you share. And that's what this movie really nails.
Yeah, the movie really allows for that to happen, whereas I think another director, maybe not as tied to the material or having created the material, would have either cut those scenes or expedited them in ways that would have done a disservice to the movie. And this one is obviously not afraid to, as unafraid it is to show extreme gore, it's equally unafraid to show moments of like humanity and intelligence and things you don't
absolutely
usually find in a Western or a horror movie.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, everybody would have, I think that I feel in certain instances, the decisions that were made would be come off as less commercial, but they were what add to the, what I feel add to the film and will make the film last longer than just, you know, a flash in the pan, you know, 90 minute Western. It's something that actually lives up to what the basis of the film is and what the foundations of Westerns are. And that's why we wanted to make it at the end of the day.
Yeah, for sure. The flip side of that Devil's Advocate stuff, what was the most difficult aspect of the movie to keep in, or the thing that caused the most sort of either discussion or argument or thing that like flip-flopped everyone or caused disarray? Was there a part?
Well, I think it depends. I would say that the most difficult part about it is reconciling what other people want versus what the filmmaker wants. And I've always been someone who ascribes, you know, back when I started studying movies and following them, I was following from the director's perspective. And that's kind of the foundation of what I feel cinema is in this modern day is you get a lot of generic stuff, and the good stuff is usually because the person helming it is someone with vision, and that's unique. And so, you know, the movie, everyone's immediately reaction is it's 2 hours and 12 minutes. And I'm like, yeah, it's 2 hours and 12 minutes, but it kind of needs to be. And could you cut it shorter? Sure. You know, you can cut anything shorter if you really want to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that would be the one difficulty is making people understand that it's 2 hours and 12 minutes and it needs to be 2 hours and 12 minutes in this instance. And we wanted it to be for the film's sake, really.
And that's the type of thing that if this movie was made with a major studio, with a bigger budget, it might actually be shorter.
Oh, absolutely.
Because there would be pressure.
I mean, especially in today's day and age when studios are just looking about how little attention span audiences have and how you need to just blast things into them or it'll just get lost. And so that seems to be kind of the mantra is fitting in as much as you possibly can, as quickly as you can, which, you know, in some instances, I think causes it to suffer as a result because you do lose things like character development that you need more time to fit in. But absolutely, I think if there were a studio movie and all that behind it, I do feel they would have cut it shorter, 100%.
It would be a 90-minute course, probably.
Yeah, it would be 90 minutes. There would have been, you know, just literally the scenes of violence and much more gunplay and all these things. But again, that's just not what the script was. You know, that's the biggest thing is when you look at this movie and if you read the script, very, very, I would say 97% of what was in that script is on screen.
Which is a rare thing to say about a movie usually.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's... it's almost, you know, especially when you have a writer and then you have the director who's interpreting the writing, and, you know, they might not like this dialogue, they might like not like that. For the most part, it's all there, and again, it's because it's the writer and director, and it's because he was so determined to make the movie he wanted to make.
Yeah, I was reading, just to give an anecdote, I was reading the Being John Malkovich script the other day, and the first, I think, 7 pages of the script are not in the movie, and these are things that in your mind, that this is a screenplay that was nominated for an Academy Award,
mm-hmm.
it's a classic, and yet so much of what was in the original thing is not on the screen, so to mm-hmm. be able to say that is a kind of amazing thing.
No, totally. It really is, and it's again, it comes down to the determination and the will of the director.
Yeah.
How much he really believed in his what he wrote, and that's the only reason we're here. It is because of what he wrote and what he directed.
And definitely dedication to, like, the violence in the movie is intense. Was there ever any concern about MPAA ratings? Because I think there's one of the most violent scenes I've ever seen in my life in this movie. Which we won't spoil, but it's literally mind-blowingly violent.
Yeah, I mean, my dad told me after watching it that he had nightmares for like 2 days afterwards. So
2 days
is definitely in
horrifying.
It definitely ranks up there, and I think it ranks up there in the top 5 of violent scenes ever, which is crazy. MPAA, you know, I wasn't privy too much to the conversations about it, but from my understanding, it is obviously, if we did try to get a rating, it would be NC-17.
Mm-hmm.
And so we linked up with a wonderful distributor, Image Entertainment, who allowed us to release it unrated.
Oh, wow.
So we didn't have to concern ourselves, and we didn't have to cut or, you know, edit anything that would have, you know, really taken away from the movie. Because it really are those scenes, as much as they're few and far between, they define the film. They give it that X factor where it's like, okay, I've never seen anything like this before.
No, for sure. That's it. That scene is probably in between that monologue and scenes of them riding across the prairie for 20 minutes. It's very, it's just like, as I said, explosion of violence.
Yeah. And it really does feel that way. And I believe that it shocks you. It kind of, and it also prepares you for that final act, which it kind of sets up really nicely.
Yeah. The stakes are immediately just like thrown from in like a completely out of the blue way, just ratcheted up.
100%.
Do you have a part of the movie that maybe, say, 30 years in the future when you're producing a movie that you'll look back and think fondly of, or something that you can see maybe your fingerprints most on it?
Well, the fingerprints question, I feel like it's just the fact that it got finished in the amount of time. Because, again, on set, you know, and this is just kind of producing in general, is you hire the right people, and then they work on set, and they get everything done and we had a wonderful production staff who were able to really just run the set and make sure that they got everything Craig needed, and Craig was able to just get everything that he had out of it that he wanted. Once you wrap, that production staff is gone. And so it was really just me, Dallas, Jack, and Craig pushing this movie through. And it was really the long hours that I put in making sure that everything was getting done, and getting done in the amount of time that we had to, because we had agreements with, you know, our foreign distribution and all of these other agreements that were contingent on time. And so it was just really pushing to get it done that I'm most proud of my work for. But really, there isn't a single thing about this movie that I don't think about fondly. It's one of the best experiences I've ever had. It's definitely, you know, when we both met at NYU, whatever, 7-8 years ago now, and then I finally ended up getting into film, this is exactly what I wanted to be doing. This was, you know, for in some respects, the dream come true. You know, it's producing a big cast, you know, a quality film, something that I'm actually very, very, very proud of. And then going, you know, I got back from Barcelona yesterday where we were at the final film festival, the Sitges Film Festival, where Craig actually, and the film won a couple of awards. It was the only festival that we were in competition for, which means that I guess we were up for awards. And so Craig took home Best Director. And
oh, great.
The film won the Critics Award for best film from the Catalonian Film Society. And so that was really, really cool to go out there. The film festival has been around for 50 years. Oliver Stone was getting an honorary award this year. Eli Roth's new movie was there. And so to go in and go up against a bunch of films that, you know, in a foreign audience that we didn't really know what to expect, and to come home with awards at the end of the day was, I mean, phenomenal. It's really like everything I could have wanted out of it. And, you know, making movies is a lot of work and a lot of time, but at the end of the day, when they come out like this, there's really no regrets. You know, everything I think about this production, even from the nuances of introducing Craig Zoller to electronic dance music on our long rides to and from set were things that I think back on fondly.
Do you think you're introducing him to EDM had any effect on the movie as a whole? You should talk about how there actually isn't any music in the movie except maybe for 5 minutes.
Speaking of music, there is only 5 minutes of music in the movie, and it was scored by Craig and his old bandmate, Jeff Hurriot. And there's literally 5 minutes. I would equate the 5 minutes very similar to the score of There Will Be Blood, however, much less significant. There's just less of it, which was a very conscious choice by Craig. He wanted no music, and if you actually listen to it, you notice the sound effects are much, much higher in terms of their volume than they are in typical movies, because he wanted you to really feel like you're out there the whole time and didn't want you to be taken out of feeling like you're with these four people on this journey for a random aside of music or just inserting score here and there. And so the only other sort of musicality that's in the movie are the windpipes of these cannibals. They have a unique way of communicating where they've had their windpipes ripped out at birth, and they have them kind of inserted in their throat like a whistle. And so they communicate with this whistle. And so that's really the only, he wanted this because he wanted most of the sound to be diegetic. And so he inserted this kind of mechanism in his throat to be that little extra bit of music amidst the, you know, 5 minutes of other music in the film. I think it really helps because so much of this movie is on the journey with the characters, and so you really do get locked into their journey and into their experience, and you are teleported into their world in some respects, and I think that's what the film is so successful at, is making you really feel this journey and feel how hopeless at times and how difficult it was to live in these times. And so I think music would have just taken them out of it. It would have been more like, oh, I'm watching this, as opposed to, oh, I'm living it with them.
Definitely, no. But in terms of naturalism, it's not something I think a viewer would think beforehand. Like, you go to a movie, you expect there to be a score, even if that score is achronological with the narrative that you're seeing. Even, as you said, There Will Be Blood, there's so much music in that movie. There's a lot of music in all of those, but there's so much music in that movie that wouldn't exist then. And that can maybe on a either subconscious level, but take you out of it. But also in terms of the amount of physicality in Bone Tomahawk, I think the silence when it is punctured, especially because Patrick Wilson's character in the movie has a broken leg, and as he gets more and more injured and can't go on, you're hearing his leg basically break more and more, and it seems like every time you hear it, it's louder, and it's more visceral. And I think if there was a quiet score beneath that, it would take away from it.
Definitely. Absolutely. Everything you said was what Craig was going for in the movie, was to make you feel that, make you feel his leg, make you feel his impossibility of his journey. And I agree. If there was music, it would have undershot the effect 100%.
And so maybe talk about the release, where people can see it. Obviously, you said it would be on demand for the local theater. I think it's in New York and L.A. originally.
Yeah, so I actually just got the list, so let me pull it up. But it's going to be in, I think, like 16 theaters on Friday. It's playing in Los Angeles, New York, Atlanta, Denver, Detroit, Houston, Kansas City, Minneapolis, Phoenix, Dallas, Lubbock, Texas, and Austin, Texas. And I'll be posting up these theaters later. And I would absolutely 100% recommend seeing the film in theaters, because even though it is a day and date release, it just everything about the score and the size of the picture and everything, just, it's a visceral experience, and it's really one that you don't want to miss. However, it will be immediately available via iTunes, DirecTV, you know, all the various cable services, VOD, same day. So for all the people who do not live in those cities, it's readily available. And, you know, hopefully it will become a VOD success, and maybe an additional rollout into more theaters is on the horizon. It all comes down to the fans. It comes down to the people who want to see it.
And maybe just the logistical, if in the event it would expand into more theaters, would you then have to go back and recut it and have it be rated, or could it still go out as uncut, unrated?
No, this is the final version of the film. So if the rating is an issue, then it just won't go there.
Good.
God knows we can't cut that scene down.
Yeah, it's essential. And do you have any other closing comments before we sign off?
No, I mean, I just the main comment is I hope people go see this film. We're very lucky that the response thus far has been excellent. It really now is down to the fans who want to see this Kurt Russell Western. It's something that, you know, it's really, really cool that he hasn't made a Western. I think 1991 was Tombstone. Now you've got, obviously, we're going to always be compared to Quentin Tarantino's Western that's happening simultaneously, The Hateful Eight. But it's very cool to be part of this particular history of the Kurt Russell Western. And I think it's a film for really all types of audiences to really enjoy and go see. I mean, I was surprised. My parents, they don't like movies. They're in their 60s, and they both really enjoyed the film. Of course, they could probably just be telling you this because I'm their son. But...
They're biased.
They tend to be pretty straight shooters. So it appeals to that audience, and it appeals to really anybody who enjoys cinema. So I would urge anybody who really wants to see a quality film, something that's not the same thing that's usually being promoted on in all the major cineplexes, and to go see this film. And if not, see it on iTunes. Get on VOD, just check it out. I would love to know what the general response is, and hopefully we'll soon.
We should also say that the movie comes out on my birthday. If people aren't going to buy me a present this year, they should definitely go see Bone Tomahawk.
100%.
If you're not in one of the cities we listed, I'll put the list of cities on my blog when I share the podcast. But if you're not in one of those cities, buy it on the
main. Are you going to go see it again?
My girlfriend wants to see it. I told her about it. I'll take her. It's being distributed by Draft House around me, so.
Yes, sir. Cool. Do you have any other random questions?
I think that's it. Yeah. No, I'll include a sign-off, too. Is there anything you want me to put in there besides the trailer and the list of cities where it's playing?
No, I think that's pretty good.
You didn't talk about future projects. If you want to talk about things that Caliber is going to do in the future, is that
there's Craig's next movie, which will be pretty cool. We're putting that together right now, and it's this badass prison / modern crime movie that is brutally violent and really well written. So hopefully we'll be getting that going soon, and a couple other a modern warfare movie and a few other things that we're kind of working on. But hopefully now that there is a decent reception of this film, we will get a lot more interest and hopefully find a few other cool projects to make.
But when those come out, you got to come back. We'll talk about those ones too.
100%.
So thanks so much, dude.
All right, cool. I appreciate it, dude.